CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 28th, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. As you know, we're celebrating Rabble's 25th anniversary this year. In another re-release from our summer archives, we're sharing an interview from 2018 with Rabble founder Judy Rebick, where she joins former Rabble Radio host Victoria Fenner in Rabble's book lounge to discuss her memoir, Heroes in My Head. Here's that interview. Take a listen.
The voices and words of Judy Rebick are well known to Rabble readers and listeners. Judy was one of the co-founders of Rabble in 2001, and she continues to be a good friend and mentor to Rabble all of these years later. In her new memoir, Heroes in My Head, she recounts many of the political battles that she's waged over the years for women's rights, a just and progressive society, and especially her involvement in the struggle to change Canada's abortion laws. And her new book shows another dimension in Judy's life. It's a truly stunning example of the phrase, the personal is political. She reveals an aspect to her life that few people have known about until now. Here's our conversation. When I first read the title of your book, Judy, it made me go, I wonder where she came up with this title. And I figured that you were referring to all of the progressive heroes who have influenced your political life. But those weren't the heroes you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. I came up with the title because the heroes in my head are the alters from, being diagnosed as multiple personalities. And the way I came up with the title, I worked on this book for 8 years. It's not an easy book to write. And about, 2 years ago, and I didn't have a title. And then 2 years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a neurophysiologist. And I told her, I mean, I'd known her for a long time, but I rarely talked about this to my, even to my, only to my closest friends, about being abused as a child and having been diagnosed with multiple personalities. So I told her about the multiple personalities, and she said, "Oh my God, Judy, you have such a beautiful brain to be able to do this," right? And so it sort of released me from seeing the alters and the multiple personalities as a negative that I had to get over, to seeing them as what I believe they are, which was a positive way that as a child I was able to defend myself from being destroyed by what my father did to me. And so, and somehow heroes in my head is what came into my head. So that's, but it could have multiple meaning. Like a deaf friend of mine wrote after he read the book, he said to me, "You're the hero in my head, Judy," you know. so it could also be about someone who, you know, helped you sometime in your life, and they remain in your head as the hero in your head when you're reminded, like Henry Morgenthaler is a hero in my head too, right? Yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I figured I've read a lot of political books and that kind of thing. I thought that that was what I was getting.
Well, most people know me as a public figure. And interestingly enough, the book seems to make people feel happy. I don't know why exactly. The response is kind of universally positive. People, I think Anna Maria kind of expressed the surprise, particularly people in the media who see me as kind of a very competent fighter and wouldn't imagine in a million years that I had serious mental health problems or issues, right? So I think that that's where the surprise is. It's kind of not a good surprise that I was abused, but it's kind of delights people in a strange way because it's a different way to look at what most people would consider. I think I look at it in a different way, what most people would consider a mental illness. I think, you know, we created this metaphor of mental illness. And I actually think a lot of what we call mental illness is really a mental injury from trauma. And it's an injury, not an illness. Well, an injury you can get better from, you know, if you have the right treatment, whereas an illness is sometimes hard to get better from. And I think some people do suffer an illness, which, you know, it's hereditary and so on, or it's a brain imbalance in the brain. But I think most people who suffer depression, anxiety, and dissociative identity disorder, it's because of trauma. If you can face the trauma, you can get over it. And I think that's a hopeful story in the book.
So at what point did you realize that there was something happening that could be addressed and could be fixed? And before that, I would imagine that it would be just like, why am I the way I am? Like, what was that turning point for you?
Well, I wasn't aware of, you know, I really did bury everything for a long, long time. I had signs of, like, for example, I suffered a series of depressions. I called them burnouts. I think a lot of activists do that, right? I called them burnouts. I was working too hard. You know, I knew I had big gaps in my memory, but I didn't really think about it too much. I thought, oh, I meet too many people. I do too many things. I don't have room in my brain for it all. Or it was kind of a joke in the family, what a bad memory I had. So I didn't really think that I had any kind of serious problem until the day the depression hit me. I suffered a very severe clinical depression in 1980. My brother, my younger brother, who I'm very close to, he said he'd seen it coming for some time. And in the book, I describe how I'd become more and more dissociated from my feelings when I was in the Revolutionary Marxist Group and the Revolutionary Workers League. So it wasn't really until that happened that I realized something was actually seriously wrong with me. But even then, I started to do therapy on it, and I realized I had been removed from my feelings in that therapy, and I started to get back in touch with my feelings, but I still didn't have a notion that was more serious than that, yeah, until 1989 when I started to have all the memories.
And that was one of the big breakthroughs then.
Yeah, I think I did have I did have sort of a flashback to being abused in the mid 80s, but I ignored it because I didn't want to deal with it, you know. And I think that not wanting to deal with it was a big part of my persona, you know. Maybe that fits better the way people know me. I just sort of said, well, I could, you know, just I'll deal with that later, right? But once the memories broke through, I call it a concrete wall, because if you're dissociated, it's not like, you know, you have a bad memory and then someone starts to tell you a story and it comes back. Dissociated memory just isn't there. It's like a concrete wall. It's buried in your subconscious, right? And so when it comes back, it's very different than a regular memory. So when my mind was flooded with all these memories, then I realized something was really wrong. And by this point also, I had a little more positive attitude toward therapy because I had been through it and it had helped me.
How did you cope and deal with this huge rush of feeling when it opened up?
Well, it wasn't really a feeling. That's the other thing. At the beginning, it wasn't feelings. It was just, I guess, confusion, right? Like, I told myself a story. You know, I'm a storyteller. I think sometimes at heart, I'm a storyteller. And so I told myself a story. I thought, okay, because I couldn't see who was abusing me. I saw it was an adult man, but I didn't know who it was. So I knew that my aunt had, my mother's younger sister had been married and had the marriage annulled 2 weeks after. So I thought, must have been that guy, you know? And they found him abusing me, and they got rid of him. And I was thinking, well, yeah, but why wouldn't they tell me once I was an adult, right? At least she might tell me. My parents might not, but she might. So anyway, but I knew I was in trouble. I couldn't think about anything else. And so I had a friend whose practice focused on survivors of childhood sexual abuse. So I called her and I went to see her right away. And then we started in on the therapy.
How difficult was the decision to you to actually write this book? I mean, you're talking about it took you 8 years to write. How long did it take before that to actually say, all right, I'm going to do this?
Well, I thought about writing a book when I went through the worst part, because I was suicidal for a while. For a few days. I just thought, because when the feeling started to kick in, it was shame that I felt. And this is not uncommon, you know, and this is the problem with keeping secrets, right? When you keep secrets, you feel shame, because why else is it secret if it's not shameful? And so I felt just overwhelming shame. And I thought, you know, that I didn't think this, but what I felt was I'm a bad person, right? Everybody thinks I'm a good person, but I'm a bad person. And now they're going to find out, so I better kill myself. You know, this was like a rational thought in my mind. And a friend of mine said, ask your therapist to keep notes and you can write about it, right? And help other women. Because at that time, there was very little about childhood sexual abuse. There was Sylvia Frazier's book, In My Father's House, which was a very brave book, and which I read, and also Courage to Heal. But there's very little societal discussion of it. It was just beginning to sort of hit the mainstream that this was a big problem. And then there was a backlash very soon after that. So I had the thought of writing a book for a long time, but then I decided, I wouldn't write a book at that point. And I wouldn't have been able to. I was just too raw. It was too raw. And then I decided, I'd wait till my parents were both gone before I'd write the book. And, I had all these journals and I had all this material and I just waited. And then when I retired from Ryerson, I was a Ginnin chair in social justice at Ryerson. I thought, okay, now's the time. I've got, I retire. I'm going to write this book. I had no idea it would take me that long. You know, every other book I've written has taken me 2 years. And that's when I was working full time, and it only took me 2 years. I'm a fast writer, right? I'm a journalist. But this one was really, really hard to write. I had to learn to write a different way.
Well, and that's really interesting because, I mean, there are parts of the book that talk about your political career, your activism, the work that you've done. And it's sort of like that was a factual sort of almost journalistic style. And then when you talked about your personal experience, it felt like there were two halves of the same story that were very different. Was that intentional or is that the
way? Yes, it was intentional. I think, and also I think the experience was like that. I was trying to reflect the experience. You know, here I was like out in on the hustings and, fighting and standing up and, all that. And then I'd go into therapy or into my house and I'd be like, this terrified little girl, right? And so that was one thing, is that I wanted to reflect that experience, because that's the experience I had for 20 years, almost 20 years. And then the other thing is that it's the only way you can explain it is to write it like a story, like a novel almost, because I have these different characters who are the alters. And fortunately, I had kept a journal, so I didn't have to rely on my memory to know what they were like, because I had it right in writing. So I had to I had to bring people into that therapy room with me or into my room with me when I was communicating with them. That was the only way I could see doing it.
You also, in the beginning of the book, you talked about the Me Too movement.
Well, I'd finished the book by the time the Me Too movement started. It was in the editing. In fact, it was in the last editing phase. But it's not that it helped me, but that it, like, I feel the Me Too, it helped you, not you personally, but it helps the reader, because the telling of secrets is becoming, in the women's movement, we always understood that the telling of secrets is essential to liberation. But that has not been a mainstream understanding until the Me Too movement. In my opinion, it has not been a mainstream understanding, but now it is. It really is. And so in another time, this book would be shocking to people, right? I think it's surprising, but I don't think it's shocking, because so many women are telling their stories, right? And I believe that, I don't just believe, it's also just statistically the case that a lot, There's really a lot of people who suffered from childhood sexual abuse or severe physical abuse who don't talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. It's horrible. So we put it away. We say it's only monsters who do this, but it's not only monsters who do it. A lot, patriarchy is men controlling women and children, and some of those men are narcissists or psychopaths or whatever they are, and they abuse the kid. And I think this is very common. I know lots and lots of people who are survivors of childhood sexual abuse. So I think that by me telling the story, I think that survivors of childhood sexual abuse should also be included in the Me Too. And it shouldn't have to be a hidden thing, which it often is, right?
Now, one thing, doing this interview with us for Rabble, I mean, you're not just an author who has written a book. You are one of the co-founders of Rabble. As I was reading the book, I was wondering, where were you, what was going on in your life, in your struggle, when you were starting Rabble?
Okay. Well, I was, this therapy ended in 1992, and I didn't start Rabble till 2001, right? Yeah. So that's quite a long period of time where, I think I'm still healing, but where I had integrated the altars and where I was learning to feel my feelings and all of that. And I think when I started Rabble, I think I was pretty together, if you want. I wasn't experiencing this kind of double life anymore. And I was more present, I'd say, and more, I could, yeah. And the way that I thought, how I got the idea for Rabble was that I had been kind of working with some other people who were trying to start an independent newspaper, and we had $1 million to work with, and it wasn't enough. And then I was working at CBC. I had a television show on CBC, and you realize how quick the internet's gone, because that was when the CBC first started their website, and they asked me to write a column. And the first column I wrote was on Kosovo. And I was like the only mainstream media person, I think, in the world who was against the war in Kosovo and against Western intervention, right? And I got all these emails in those days, because we didn't have social media, taking up what I had said, supporting it, criticizing it. It was really interesting. And I got 200 emails, which now is nothing, but then was amazing. Because if you wrote a column, if you got 3 letters to the editor, it was a lot, you know? So I thought, wow, this would be a good medium to do an independent newspaper, is how we thought of it then. And so I used to speak a lot across the country. So everywhere I spoke, I asked for a meeting of people interested in alternate media, but make sure half of them are under 30, since I felt younger people were much more hip to what was happening. And they all said, great idea, all the young people. And the older people didn't think it was such a great idea. Great idea, but make sure it's interactive. And that's how we got Babbel, right? And, when you think about it, Babbel precedes Facebook, right? So it was quite an innovative thing that we did. And I think then I was much more capable of working cooperatively and collectively with people, which we did with, Libby and Libby Davis and Sven Robinson, in people in the NDP, and people like Naomi Klein I'm losing names, but anyway, so, and a number of younger people who had been part of the anti-globalization movement. So we managed to pull together a pretty politically diverse group of people to do it, and it took off. It was amazing, especially Babbel at the beginning. Babbel was the success,
and it's still pretty lively.
Yeah.
So just wrapping up, this is such a complex subject. The alters are the heroes in your head, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And why are they heroes?
Well, because, I was 5 years old when this started, and I told my grandmother, and she hit me and said schmutz, which means dirt in Yiddish. And, my father said I couldn't tell my mother. So no one helped me. No one helped me. So I had to help myself. That's how I see it. And a child has one thing, which is her imagination. And I think this is what I did. And as a result, I was protected in a way. You know, obviously it wasn't a complete protection because at some point I had to deal with it. But dealing with something when you're 40 is something quite different than trying to deal. Children experience emotions as overwhelming experience, and a child can't deal with it, just can't. It's unbearable for a child. And so this happened, and I actually think there's a lot more people who have multiple personalities than we know about, because it makes you kind of hyper-functional. It makes you be able to do things, you know, work harder, all of that, than most people. And since in our society, all we care about is how productive people are, not all, but most of what we care about is productive. I was super productive. And so, and I think people who have this condition tend to be super productive. My therapist said that of all the women, and she, you know, her whole practice was with survivors of sexual abuse, it was the multiple personalities who were most successful in their lives. Now, it doesn't do a lot for, you know, love relationships, right? That's where I suffered, but I probably would have suffered anyway, because my generation of women, it was pretty hard to have a decent relationship with a man in those days, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So that's where, but that suffering is private, right? That limitation is private. And in the public sphere, I did pretty well, especially given that I was such a radical. So I think there's probably more people with this condition than we know about, because it's considered quite rare. I don't think it's all that rare. I just think they don't seek help because they don't think they need help.
That was Judy Rebick, activist, journalist, and co-founder of Rabble.ca. You've been listening to Rabble Radio, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner. Thanks for listening.
That was a clip from Rabble Radio from an episode from 2018 featuring then Rabble Radio host Victoria Fenner and Rabble founder Judy Rebick. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Let's jump right in. Starting this week in national politics, labor unions expressed their support for the government's decision to pull out of trade talks with the U.S., but said that to weather the storm, workers will need greater supports. Last week, Canadian negotiators walked away from trade talks with the U.S., leading to a 50% tariff on a range of Canadian goods. Prime Minister Mark Carney responded with counter-tariffs on the U.S. and acknowledged this decision could lead to tough economic times for Canadians. Unions like Unifor, the United Steelworkers, and the Canadian Labour Congress are calling on the government to increase employment insurance supports for workers who may lose their jobs because of the tariffs. Canada chose to walk away from the trade talks after U.S. representatives made demands that Canada surrender some of its sovereignty. The U.S. wanted Canada to raise tariffs on any other country that the U.S. also had tariffs against. The U.S. also wanted the right to allow President Donald Trump to cancel the deal whenever he felt like it. Carney said that Canada will not return to the negotiating table unless the U.S. does first. In provincial news, while most of Canada's premiers have shown solidarity in the face of the heightened trade war with the U.S., Alberta Premier Daniel Smith is not one of them. Instead, Smith has argued against counter-tariffs against the U.S., and is instead advocating for appeasing Donald Trump. Smith said that Canada should focus on, quote, being smarter, more strategic, more agile, and using our reputation and relationship with the American people to have these tariffs reversed, end quote. Smith also said that despite the threats to Canada's sovereignty, she would not consider postponing this October's referendum on whether or not Alberta should explore separation from Canada. Leader of the Alberta NDP and leader of the official opposition Nahed Nenshi argued that now was not the time to potentially weaken Canada with a threat of separation, and that doing so would only strengthen the hand of Donald Trump. In labor news, the Association of Ontario Midwives is calling for better pay and working conditions for their members. For years, midwives have been underpaid, despite being classified as health workers. A report from earlier this year stated unequivocally that Ontario is in the midst of a crisis in retention and recruitment of midwives. The Association of Midwives is currently in the process of renegotiating a new contract with the province. Midwives say that the current negotiation framework revealed undeniably that midwifery recruitment, retention, and ultimately the sustainability of maternity care in Ontario is under threat. Midwives also saw their pay reduced by Ontario Premier Doug Ford during the years of 2019 to 2023. During that time, Ford capped compensation increases for public sector workers in the province to just 1% a year. When the compensation restrictions were lifted, other public sector workers, like nurses, were entitled to back pay for the wages that they would have earned. Midwives have yet to receive any form of compensation for lost wages. The Association of Ontario Midwives is recommending a 6% compensation increase for its members, something that the provincial government has rejected. Also this week, activists are organizing against Prime Minister Mark Carney's so-called CEO Summit. On September 14th to 15th, a who's who of global finance will descend on a luxury Toronto hotel. Top officials at firms managing nearly $120 trillion are expected to attend. At 6 p.m. on September 14th, as the CEO Summit gets underway, demonstrators will gather at Nathan Phillips Square for the Confront Carney's CEO Summit rally. The Council of Canadians, Eighth Fire Rising, World Beyond War, the Revolutionary Communist Party, Lead Now, and Capitalism Can't Be Fixed are among a growing number of organizations mobilizing. In addition to the rally, the Many Versus the Money Counter Summit will be taking place at the Ontario College of Art and Design, also in Toronto. This counter summit will feature organizers from labor, Indigenous sovereignty, tenant, climate, anti-war, migrant rights, and Palestine solidarity movements. Naomi Klein and Kianga Yamanta Taylor are among the announced keynote speakers. And finally, in environmental news, writer and author David Suzuki argues that solving the climate crisis will require solidarity with Indigenous peoples. The 57th session of the International Permanent Peoples Tribunal on Missing and Disappeared Indigenous Children and Unmarked Graves in Canada took place earlier this summer in Montreal. Suzuki said that truth and reconciliation for the crimes perpetrated against Indigenous peoples is key for protecting the environment and building a better future, writing, quote, "Repairing relationships with communities and with the land is how we build a future that's just for everyone," end quote. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content of Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to Rabble.ca at rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nuremberg for supplying the music to this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time.